Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. What happens when an Israeli from a Zionist military family meets Palestinians and hears their side of the story?
I never knew that there was a Palestinian narrative that was completely different. I thought it was agreed upon that they hated us, they wanted to destroy us, and we prevailed because we were stronger and smarter.
Miko Peled has now concluded that there is merit to the Palestinians' point of view, that much of what he used to believe about Israel was upside down, and he's arrived at this rather hopeful conclusion.
People always say, oh, it's been going on for hundreds of years, for thousands of years, and it's never going to be solved. Well, it hasn't. It's been going on for maybe 70, 80 years, and it was created by people, and it can be solved by people.
I'm thrilled to welcome as this week's guest on Talk Nation Radio, Miko Peled, who is a peace activist who dares to say in public what many choose to deny. Miko was born in Jerusalem in 1961 into a well-known Zionist family. His grandfather, Dr. Avraham Katznelson, was a Zionist leader and a signer of Israel's Declaration of Independence. His father, Mati Peled, was a young officer in the 1948 war and a general in the war of 1967 when Israel conquered the West Bank, Gaza, the Golan Heights, and Sinai. The political became personal for Miko Peled when on September 4, 1997, his niece, Smadar, 13, was killed in a suicide attack in Jerusalem. Miko Peled has written a book, brand new book, a wonderful book, called The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Miko, thanks for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Sure, thank you. It's a pleasure.
It's an absolutely wonderful book, foreword by Alice Walker. It's an argument, but it's a narrative. It's your father's story and your story, and it struck me as a terrific book for changing people's minds about Israel. Was that the intention, or what was the purpose in writing this?
Well, there are several purposes. Certainly, changing people's minds is one of the objectives. Although that's not an easy thing to do, but I think more importantly, perhaps. Demonstrating that a transformation is possible, and that reconciliation is possible, and that it's important, although it's difficult, but it's important to always look at your own side and really have a good understanding, a fearless understanding, I should say, of what your own side did in any given conflict. As opposed to always looking at the other side and blaming, and this is, you know, it's a chapter out of, you know, how to deal with people anyway. But we somehow, when we get into nations, it becomes a little more difficult. How to develop relations with people? A lot of people have already realized this. You know, you seek to understand before you seek to, you know, become understood. But when we talk about nations and conflicts, this doesn't seem to ever apply. So it's important to take a really good look, and that's what I had to do, take a really good look at my side, the side from which I come, and how it impacted the conflict. And plus, when you have a better understanding of your own side, then I think it helps to strengthen your own identity. That's what happened with me. It strengthens your own identity. It strengthens who you are. It gives you a clearer view of the situation, but also of where you stand in a given conflict. So the book set out to do a lot of those things, and there are a lot of facts. I think there are a lot of issues, a lot of myths that are out there, and I think it's important for people to get over the myths and start taking a good look at what actually took place in this conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. One example is people always say, "Oh, it's been going on for hundreds of years, for thousands of years, and it's never going to be solved." Well, it hasn't. It's been going on for maybe 70, 80 years, and it was created by people, and it can be solved by people. So these were some of the objectives that I had in mind.
I think that's an excellent point to begin with. Maybe we should start with 1948 and the founding of Israel. What was the understanding of that in general terms that you grew up with, and what is your understanding now of what occurred?
The common myth or the common belief that, you know, among Israelis and interestingly among Americans too. Is that there was a small Jewish community that had, you know, come back, returned to its historical homeland, and was beginning to form itself into some kind of a national home or a state, And the Arab countries and the local Arabs, the Arabs of Palestine, decided to destroy it. And therefore they attacked in 1947, 1948, with the intent to destroy this fledgling state, this new state in the making. And miraculously, the smaller, less equipped, less trained, less prepared Jewish community was able to come out victorious, which is interesting. And when you're a kid and you want to believe that sort of thing, then it's wonderful, especially when your dad was part of the, you know, was an officer and, you know, your family lived the entire process. So that's the first myth, that a lot of what it means to be an Israeli, a lot of the identity that we have as Israelis has to do with how the state of Israel was created. It suits us well. It's how we've been, what we've been taught, that we are always, and we always have been historically as Jews, a minority where people tried to kill us, and we were persecuted everywhere. And at all these moments in history, we somehow rose and were able to defeat our, you know, the larger, stronger, and meaner forces, so to speak. You know, it was the Greeks in the days of the Maccabees, and it was the Romans in the days of, you know, the great Bar Kokhba and all these other, you know, all these other myths. And it was King David, of course, when he was a child against Goliath, which really set the tone for this whole sense of Israelis being smaller but wiser and having God on their side.
Yeah, I was named for that guy, I believe. I guess it's a little jarring, or it sounds completely off track when you hear that many of the people of the region refer to that glorious war of independence and that struggle by an underdog as the catastrophe.
Yeah, that was very insulting. I mean, how could they refer to this glorious, wonderful moment where we, the Jews, finally had our own state and finally were able to come out victorious and reclaim our land and reclaim our independence after thousands of years and call it a catastrophe? I mean, it's a personal affront, really, when you think about it as an Israeli. And it took me a very long time to come to terms with that, that this is how they see it and that maybe there's some merit to that. But it wasn't until relatively late in life, I was almost 40 years old and I was living in America, that I heard the Palestinian narrative for the first time. Because even though I grew up in Jerusalem, I didn't know any Palestinians. Jerusalem is very segregated, as the rest of Israel and Palestine are. I mean, you've got, the communities are mixed. They're not mixed. They're very close to one another, but they are completely segregated. So I never knew that there was a Palestinian narrative that was completely different. I thought it was agreed upon that they hated us, they wanted to destroy us, and we prevailed because we were stronger and smarter. And little by little, I started hearing stories in a dialogue setting where it was a narrative. It was somebody's personal story, as opposed to kind of a debate where somebody's attacking you and you have to defend your own side. And what was interesting is that the same stories came up over and over again. It's not these people all sat together and planned this this narrative, but everybody I met had a grandfather or had a story of their own, or they were a child, or they were, you know, if they're older, you know, if they talk to older people, then this was their story. And I started reading more about things that were books that Palestinians have written about the period of 1947, 1948, and then historians like Ilan Pape, who wrote pretty courageously about what took place during those years. And the picture that was that came out is completely different than the picture that I was told. Now, the reality is that, you know, the Jewish community was small, the smaller of the two in numbers. There was probably maybe half a million, Jews that were living in Palestine at the time, and maybe a million, two, a million, three Palestinians. So, I mean, the Jewish community was much smaller, and the two communities were kind of developing on parallel lines to become states. They both wanted a state in Palestine. But the one thing that the Jewish community had invested in, and the Palestinians did not, was an army, was a militia, was a fighting force. And even though the Jewish community was smaller, it had a very significant fighting force by 1947 that was well-armed and well-trained, and also, more importantly perhaps, very well-indoctrinated. My dad used to say how all these Zionist ideologues would come and give them speeches when they were young. And he volunteered to the Palmach, the the Jewish militia when he was 16 years old, while still in high school. And he recalls all these training camps that not only included, you know, military training, but also all these lectures that lasted sometimes for 3 and 4 hours by these ideologues that they all admired. And these were older Jews, older Zionists, the generation of my grandparents. They were prepared, and they knew they had a mission, and their mission was to deliver the land of Israel back to the Jewish people. This was their mission, and this has nothing to do with the Holocaust. This is decades before the Holocaust.
So how many fighters would you say the Jews had and the Palestinians had?
Well, the best estimates that are out there today say that the Jewish forces at the beginning of the conflict, which is around the end of 1947, the beginning of 1948, were around 40,000 armed fighting men. And the Palestinians really didn't have a fighting force. They had little, they were called gangs. They were called gangs by the Jews. But these were small militias, and altogether, at best, they were maybe somewhere between 8,000 and 10,000. But it wasn't a trained force. These were groups of soldiers that came together in order to, as a response to the attacks by the Zionists. It was a completely different kind of a thing. Whereas the Zionist forces were well trained and they were armed, and this was a planned kind of a thing to have a militia. And then you take a look at what happened between the end of 1947, when the United Nations decided to, on the partition, where there would be two states, a state for the Jews and a state for the Arabs, and then the end of 1948, which is when this war ended. So 12-month period. And the picture that you see is that within 12 months, the Zionist forces were able to conquer almost 80% of the country. They were able to destroy more than 500 towns and villages, and some of these towns and villages were historically, it's very important, some of them were older than 1,000 years old. And they managed to forcibly exile almost 1 million people. Now, when you're the smaller, weaker force that's fighting for your life, how do you accomplish all of this in 12 months? And at one point, of course, once the British left in May of 1948, then some of the Arab armies joined the battle in order to, you know, save Palestine, so to speak. But of course, it was by then the Jewish forces were close to 100,000. And again, they were trained and they were motivated, and the Arab armies were not, and they were no match for them. So you had a 12-month period at the end of which you had a Jewish state, and Palestine was completely erased off the map. And the reality was that Israel was created on the ashes of a country to be. And then it was easy to create this impression that, well, actually there were no people there, there was no state there, there was no culture there, they had no political identity, these were just nomads, and these were just people who were lost. And the ones that remained were lost. They were completely destroyed. I mean, suddenly their entire world collapsed in front of their eyes. And they had no homes, and they had no cities, and they had no country, and they had no clue what was going on. Suddenly this forest came and destroyed everything they had. And then Israel went on to pass these laws that forbade the refugees from returning, and then allowed the state to confiscate their land because the land was not used, because there was nobody there. They were absentees. You know, and of course, then the rest was history. So when you look at that compared to what we hear today on a regular basis, I mean, I think it's in some of the history books that kids in America learn in high school, never mind what the American kids in Israel learn in high school, that the Jews were attacked by the Arabs who wanted to destroy them, and they prevailed because they were strong, whatever. You could say God was on their side, or witch was on their side, or whatever the case may be. But that doesn't add up when you see the results of the war. Of course, doesn't add up. And when you look at the numbers and you hear the stories and you read the history books, then of course you see this was a myth. And so much of this is a part of Israeli identity, being this David and the David and Goliath comparison. Is almost, if you're not that, then almost, well, then what does it mean to be an Israeli? You know, because we were always, this goes along with the indoctrination of us as the successors of the Maccabees and the successors of King David and so on, which may or may not historically be true, but that's kind of how we were raised.
It's a very strikingly different story from the one that many people begin with, and I think your book, Miko Peled, your book, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, does a wonderful job of taking people gradually to that very different conclusion, as you arrived at it gradually during your life, and part of it is through a discussion of later myths, including those surrounding the War of 1967, which your father played a major role in as a general. Can you talk very briefly again about the sort of two contrasting visions of what happened in 1967?
Yes, the myth continues. In other words, the myth that exists today is that the Arabs want to destroy Israel. And they are the successors of the Nazis, who are the successors of the Cossacks who created the pogroms, who are the successors of the Romans and the Greeks and the Inquisition and everybody else around that always wanted to kill Jews. Now, that's not to say that a lot of it isn't true. I mean, in Christian Europe, killing Jews for the last 2,000 years was part of the culture. It wasn't that some of this isn't true. But that had nothing to do with the Arabs, of course. And that had nothing to do with the Arabs, certainly not the Arabs of Palestine. This is true for Christian Europe, but it fits really, really well with the story, with an ongoing myth, an ongoing narrative that was created in order to justify what Israel does. And then once again, in 1967, the reality was that the Egyptians did violate the ceasefire agreement, and they did give the Israelis a legally, at least, a reason to begin a war, but not necessarily a justification to begin a war. And you had these two forces within Israel, one that was pushing for war, which was the army, and one which was trying to hold on and say, wait, maybe we can resolve this diplomatically. There are other issues. There's a larger, you know, we have the superpowers. We have all these things here that we need to resolve, which was the cabinet. And what's interesting is the cabinet members were older. They were in their mid to late 60s. They were almost all of them had immigrated from Eastern Europe. They had this historical outlook on the situation. Or different, I should say, different historical outlook. They had lived through the pogroms, and many of them remember the Holocaust. It was only 20 years or so, 25 years after the Holocaust. And then you had the generals who were mostly born in Palestine. They all participated in the Haganah and the Palmach, which were the Jewish militia. They were in their early 40s, and they were ready, they were ready to strike. They wanted to be assertive and to strike, and they knew that they were going to be victorious. And they had trained for the day where they could do this again, and they'd done it twice already before. They'd done it in 1947, they'd done it in 1956 with the Sinai campaign, and they knew that they were ready to fight. And with all the books and all the histories, and I should say the history books and the documentaries that had been written and made about this period, when I looked into this myself in preparing for the book, there was one thing that I found that was striking that I didn't see or it was never mentioned anywhere in anything that I saw before. And that is that the generals were actually telling the cabinet members and discussing among themselves that the Egyptian army was not prepared for war. Mm-hmm. So there was no threat. There was no, certainly not an existential threat, but not even a military threat. And they say this over and over again. The Egyptian army needs at least a year and a half to 2 years in order to be prepared for war. Therefore, we must strike now because we have an opportunity to crush them. This was the discussion. And the cabinet would come back, the prime minister would come back with all these things about what we have to think about the diplomacy, and maybe there's a way to do this without a war, and we have to think of all the casualties. And the generals, my dad particularly, and a couple of others that were particularly harsh in their words, particularly towards the prime minister in these meetings, insisted that the Israeli army had proven itself to be invincible, quite frankly, and they deserve the opportunity to do and for their opinions to be taken at face value, and they should be given the opportunity to go in and fight this war again. And in the end, they used two main tactics. One was to perpetuate this myth that there is an existential threat, and they talk about this too. They say, well, the line is going to be, because the government had decided to wait, had a meeting decided to wait, and they had another meeting decided to wait on the one hand, but on the other hand, they'd already called up the reservists. There was all this tension going on. So the army decided to say, well, the government decided to wait, but the threat still exists. There's still an existential threat. This is what people knew. I mean, people, I remember, I was a child, but, as a child, you hear what the grown-ups are talking about, and that there was an existential threat, that they were coming to get us. The Arabs were coming to kill us. And then it was all over in 6 days. finally, the cabinet succumbed to the pressure and gave the army the authority to strike against Egypt. And this was the authority the army was given to strike against Egypt. They were able to destroy the Egyptian army very quickly, take the Sinai and the Gaza Strip. And then they saw an opportunity to continue the war, take the West Bank, fight off the Syrians, and take the Golan Heights. And they did this without government approval. The Moshe Dayan, who was defense minister, and the generals on the ground decided to do this themselves. And they were very successful, of course, because both the Jordanian army and the Syrian army were no match for the IDF in any way, shape, or form. Not only were they not a threat, but they were not even remotely a match. And, of course, the whole thing was over in 6 days. And in 6 days, the size of the country was multiplied by three. I mean, they managed to increase the size of the country by three. They managed to take the West Bank, which Israelis had always wanted, and many Israelis felt, especially in the army, that the fact that it wasn't taken in 1948 was a big mistake, that Hebron and East Jerusalem and Nab and Shechem and all these biblical places, biblical names, were not taken then, and they should have been, and they could have been, from their perspective. And the Golan Heights was, they felt strategically this was an important place, and it had water, and basically this was, an opportunity to show who's boss. And they managed to kill upwards of 15,000 soldiers in those 6 days at a cost of 700 Israeli casualties. They managed to capture, they had the largest stockpiles of Russian-made arms outside of Russia for the first time, And this was all done in 6 days. And once again, it doesn't add up. If you're fighting a defensive war, if everybody's coming to attack you, how do you accomplish all of this? How do you destroy three armies, kill so many soldiers, and conquer so many lands? Now, it fits really well with the myth, because this is historically what Jews were able to always do. David beat Goliath against all odds. The Maccabees, beat the Greeks, and so on and so on and so on. So this is, we did this in 1947 again when we were attacked, and we were the minority. So this fits very, very well with the myth. It doesn't sit well when you look at the facts.
In fact, it sounds like preemptive war rather than defensive war. And I met a man about a year ago named Ben Ferenc, who lives in Florida, who is, I think, the last living prosecutor from Nuremberg, who said that he believes U.S. policy now of waging preemptive war is essentially what they prosecuted the Nazis for. In Nuremberg, would you agree with that assessment?
Well, I'm not an expert on Nuremberg or World War II, so I don't want to say anything. But I think that when you look at what the U.S. does today around the world, it's very similar to what Israel has been doing. And so I think there's a case here where I think George Bush, for example, really wanted to be Arik Sharon. He wanted to be able to do that, to walk around and conquer things and kill people at will. And that's what he did in Iraq, and now that's what they're doing with this whole war on terror, where they have this list of people and they decide who they're going to kill this week. And that's exactly what the Israelis were doing with their targeted assassinations of Palestinians. So there's a lot of similarity, I think, between what America is doing today and what Israel has been doing over the last 65 years.
Your father foresaw a lot of this. He predicted a brutal occupation if these territories were to be occupied in 1967. Is that correct?
Yes. He said immediately after the war, a week after the war, in the very first meeting that the general staff had, the Israeli Army General Staff had, he said, well, now finally we have an opportunity to create a Palestinian state and solve the Palestinian problem. And people looked at him like he lost his mind. We finally have we have the old city of Jerusalem. We have Hebron and Shiloh and all these. We have access to the Jordan River, access to the entire Jordan River. What are you talking about giving back lands? And he said, well, we have a population here that shares the land with us. As principal, the Zionist organization and the State of Israel later on agreed to the principle of partition, which the UN, what the UN decided to do with Palestine back in 1947. He said, now we have an advantage because we have more land, we're stronger. And he said the local Palestinian population will accept this. In fact, the local Palestinian leadership came up immediately to the army and said, well, let's now make peace between us. We don't need to deal with these other Arab countries. With these Arab leaders, with these Arab dictators. And of course, they were all shut down and made to shut up. The Israelis didn't want to hear about it. And he said, well, if we don't do this, then that means we're going to have to control or to rule these people against their will, which means there will be resistance inevitably, which means we're going to have to quell this resistance, and we're going to become a brutal occupying power, and this is going to destroy the moral fabric of the army and the moral fabric of the Jewish state, of our democracy. And he said this would be a perfect solution for us to have peace with an Arab country, a small Arab country that is created in order to live alongside us in peace, and this will be a bridge to making peace with the Arab countries, and we can move on from, you know. But they didn't want to move on. You know, people like Shimon Peres, who yesterday received the Medal of Freedom, and others saw this an opportunity for settlement. And right away, the settlement project began, and Jewish towns or towns for Jewish Israelis were being built in the West Bank. And of course, over the last 45 years, what my father said then became true. Israeli army became a brutal terrorist organization. I think it's the only way to characterize it. And the settlement project went completely crazy with investments of billions and billions of dollars in the West Bank, only to bring Jews there to settle, and not a dime for Palestinians, who make up the majority of the population in the West Bank. And the full intent of continuing the ethnic cleansing that began in 1947, and to continue the ethnic cleansing of Palestine so that there would be a Jewish majority, a clear Jewish majority in all of Palestine, all of the land of Israel. And to this end, you know, Israel does what it does all the way till today.
It's a remarkable story. I wish we could continue, but our time is up for this week. But I highly recommend to everyone listening that you pick up a copy of Miko Peled's book, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, which tells this story as well as his own personal story of how he came to meet and know Palestinians in the United States and in Palestine and learn their point of view. Miko Peled, thank you very, very much for being on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you.
Let me close out this edition of Talk Nation Radio with something I should do more, let you know about activities and events. Over at rootsaction.org, we are about to stop the military from spending $80 million a year on NASCAR sponsorships. Then we'll move on to the next chunk of our resources to cut from the military and put to good use, and the Army will have to figure out a different way to attract its killers. At veteransforpeace.org, we've got information on our upcoming convention in Florida. I'm an associate member who does work for the organization. At warisacrime.org, where I spend most of my time, you can click on events and find something for everyone everywhere. I'll be in Minneapolis this Friday and in Wisconsin at Peace Stock on Saturday, along with Roy Bourgeois of School of the Americas Watch and Josh Rubner of the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation. And two political parties hold conventions this summer worthy of the biggest protests ever endured by any gang of sold-out misrepresentatives ever to crawl across the earth. This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, engineered by Christiane Brown in Reno, Nevada, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. Until next time.